Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And you know how New York values has become a derisive talking point in the presidential campaign? It would not be a New York value to let this go by without a response, and in our case, a creative response. So we are doing a 7-day New York values series here on The Brian Lehrer Show. We started it yesterday with the question, what are New York values to you, and what are New York values to your red state relatives? Today we'll take a ride in our Wayback Machines to learn about the 17th century origin of some core New York values that persist to this day. Maybe you know the amazing 2004 book about this called The Island at the Center of the World, which refers to Manhattan Island, and tells the story of the time when the Dutch ruled this place and called it New Amsterdam and really set New York up for what it's become, values included. The author of The Island at the Center of the World, Russell Shorto, joins us now. Hi, Russell. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Great to be with you again.
Henry Hudson sailed into these waters in 1609. What was he looking for?
He was looking for Asia. At the time, they thought that the world was smaller than it is, and that he had this theory that North America was thinner than it is, and that there would be a strait, a channel that would go from the Atlantic to the Pacific. So he thought he would nose around in the East Coast, find that channel and head west, and instead of getting to Ohio, basically, he'd come out into the Sea of Japan, and there would be the riches of Asia before him.
Huh. So they didn't learn that much from when Columbus sailed in 1492 and kind of made the same mistake. You've said that the way the Dutch ran the city, it planted the seeds for New York's immigrant culture. How did they do that?
That they brought two things, which were totally Dutch for the time, and in many ways still are, free trade and tolerance. The Dutch pioneered free trade, being very efficient with your low tariffs and always looking for cost-cutting measures, and tolerance. You know, the Netherlands was and is a flat place, and it was easy to flee to if you were fleeing persecution from somewhere else. And so they developed, you know, in Europe in the 17th century, intolerance was official policy in England, in France, in Spain, which was common sense. The idea was, if we're going to get ahead, we all have to be on the same page, and most importantly to them, a state religion. So the Netherlands has this mixed population because of its flatness and because it's a seafaring place. And they turned that wisdom on its head and kind of enshrined tolerance of differences as a value. So those two things, when they founded a colony, the colony was called New Netherland. The capital, New Amsterdam, was at the southern tip of Manhattan Island. When they founded that colony, which they did for trade reasons and so on, all of that came with them.
The Dutch and the Dutch West India Company had other colonies in their empire, as you just referred to. Were they clones of New York, if I can put it that way, being established elsewhere in the world in a values sense?
No. New York ended up being unique. I mean, the Dutch colony of New Netherland was not like, you know, they had outposts all over. They were the only European country that traded with Japan. They were all over the East Indies, that is to say Indonesia, in India. But no place took on the characteristics that New Netherland did, and that had to do with the kind of population that settled in what would become New York. It was intensely mixed because the Dutch themselves were right from the start. In 1642, there were 18 languages being spoken in New Amsterdam, and the population was probably only about 500 people then. So, you know, I'd like to say that New York was New York even before it was New York. So all of that came with them, and that group of people then decided, I think the story beneath the story of New York's founding is it was founded by the West India Company as kind of a, you know, money-making enterprise. But this mixed population decided, they were putting down roots, they were intermarrying, they were doing what you do when you form a society, and they decided that they wanted all the full blanket of rights and so on from the Dutch Republic to apply to them. So they fomented, they wanted They wanted civilization. They wanted respect.
The tension that we see to this day is between the New York values of commerce and idealism. How much was that a visible tension in New Amsterdam from the start?
It was indeed there from the start. I think, though, that from the start, what you have in New Amsterdam, which transfers into New York and which starts to distinguish it from Boston and other places in the colonies, is this mixed population. And the other thing that the Dutch were and are very good at is practicality. You know, I'm talking about tolerance as this thing that kind of forms a social glue. But the Dutch have a word which is impossible to say and to define precisely. The word is gedogen. And it means, my definition of it is technically illegal, but officially tolerated. And it's a way to get around things. If you're a practical people, this is like an eminently practical card that you can play. And you see it, for example, in their policy with marijuana. I mean, marijuana is illegal in the Netherlands, but there are, quote, coffee shops where you can buy marijuana anywhere. And if you go to a police officer and ask, where can I buy marijuana? It'll say, the coffee shop. But the crucial thing is, if the coffee shop changed its name to a marijuana shop, they'd close it down, because that's kind of breaking the little. And so that applies, that kind of practicality gets taken up, I think, by New York, by New Amsterdam, and then by New York, and begins, is one of the things that sets it apart.
In your book, you tell the story significantly through the eyes of two individuals who represented these competing New Amsterdam values. Peter Stuyvesant, who I think every New York City public school kid learns about in fourth grade or when they apply to Stuyvesant High School from their apartment in Stuyvesant Town, and Adriana van der Donk, who they don't learn about. Who was Adriana van der Donk, and why did the peg-legged Stuyvesant, who's kind of the bad guy of the two, get so memorialized while van der Donk has been so forgotten?
Yeah, they're both really strong characters. And this is, you know, right now, I mean, as we speak, PBS is making a dramatic series out of the book, and we're wrestling with this, like, who's van der Donk and who's Stuyvesant and how can they, you know, portray those? Stuyvesant was the director of the colony. He was a West India Company official. Van der Donk, as I said before, the real story is how the colonists themselves were struggling against that sort of company rule, and van der Donk becomes appointed as their leader. So he's sort of the head of the opposition party. And the struggle between the two of them is a struggle between two different visions of what this place, that is to say New York, could become. Stuyvesant was trying to hold to the company policy, which is, this is a place where we're making money off of beavers and tobacco. And van der Donk, and he makes this appeal directly to the powers that be in the Netherlands, and he writes a book about it for popular dissemination. He makes this case that, look, you don't have any idea what we've got. We've got this chunk of land. We've got this island. We've got this magnificent natural harbor. It sits astride this continent that's so vast, we don't even know how big it is. One day, and we've got this Dutch notion of tolerance and this trading ethos, and all of that together is going to make this place someday outstrip the home country, provided you supply us and give us the support that it ought to have. And if it doesn't, he said, the English are going to come in and take it over, because the English are in New England and the English are in Virginia, and it's only a matter of time. So he was very prescient.
And the English did eventually come in and take it over. But these competing values, did they ultimately contribute to each of the other one flourishing, the idealism and the commerce, or was it more of a zero-sum game?
They were both there. I think in New York, I mean, I wrote a piece in the New York Times a while ago about values, about sort of New York values and American values, if you can call them different things. And I looked at them as kind of two different political strains, the larger one being this very theological, ideological notion that comes out of the Puritans in New England, because they were the Puritans and the Dutch in New Netherland were kind of the in competition. And from them, of course, they came to New England seeking the promised land, and then they decided, okay, this is the promised land, and we have the right to it. And then in the 19th century, that becomes manifest destiny, this idea that we have the right to spread over the whole continent. And that becomes enshrined in one strand of politics, of political values, this very kind of highbrow or ideological notion. The New Netherland, the New York, the New Amsterdam, the Dutch tradition is much more embedded in factions, which is really what politics is about, and coalition building and practicality. And I think that is one convenient way of looking at the differences between at the historic differences.
So how much of a stretch is it to say we see this tension enshrined in New York values to this day? Wall Street and Occupy Wall Street, both such New York institutions, the capitalist Donald Trump from Queens and the socialist Bernie Sanders from Brooklyn, both so recognizable as New York figures.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, any thesis or metaphor only stretches so far, right? But I think it's true. Bernie Sanders represents something that goes back to FDR, for that matter, that goes back to Boss Tweed. I mean, he was in a way the original one who saw the power of groups and the power of the political power of the disenfranchised, and he took advantage of it. But on the other hand, New York is also, I mean, it's such a big place. It's also the birthplace of the American Communist Party and of the conservative movement, you know, William F. Buckley and the National Review. And Trump stands in a long line of megalomaniacal tycoons.
Now we know what Trump is described as by Russell Shorto, author of the classic book, which I didn't know until you told me is being made into a series by PBS. That's so great. Classic book about New York and New York values called The Island at the Center of the World, the epic story of Dutch Manhattan and the forgotten colony that shaped America. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.